Welcome to Aspects of Riding with your host, James Kelly. For the next 60 minutes, we'll explore every aspect of riding, including how to create, format, and even sell your work. Now, let's get writing. Here's your host, James Kelly.
Hello and welcome to Aspects of Riding. I'm your host, James Kelly. My co-host for today's show is Joyce K. Gatchenberger, and our guests are Scott Decker and Alan Livingston. And the topic of the show is what makes a rider. So Joyce, please tell us a little about who you are.
Certainly, and thanks for having me here today. My name is Joyce K. Gatchenberger. I have published a couple of books. My first one is Lines of Listening, and it talks about generational child abuse and marital betrayal. It is nonfiction. The second one is Generations Intertwine, which is a continuation of the first. I'm working on my next book, which will be a much more positive book. I'm an RN. I've been in practice for 35 years, and as you can tell, I'm also an author. I'm very happy to be here today.
All right. And our first guest is Scott Decker, and Scott is a former FBI agent. He spent his early FBI career in the pursuit of bank and armed car robberies throughout Boston. Several of his cases formed the real-life basis for the Warner Brothers 2010 full-length motion picture, The Town. He also appeared with Sandra Bullock in 2013's action comedy, The Heat, and served as a technical producer for the Golden Globe winner John Hamm's narration for the short film History of FBI Weapons, which is presented daily in the new FBI tour at the J. Edgar Hoover Building. In 2017, the tour became the FBI Experience. In 1997, Decker joined the Bureau's fledgling Hazardous Materials Response Unit in Quantico. On September 12, 2001, he led a team of FBI hazmat specialists to Ground Zero in New York City. 3 weeks later, the country came under attack again, this time from anthrax. Before it ended, the anthrax attacks killed 5 people and permanently injured nearly 24 more. Returning from New York, Decker requested assignment to a newly formed anthrax task force. Decker coordinated the early genetics and DNA forensics for the investigation. He then went on to supervise a squad of agents, all with advanced science degrees, as they coordinated the forensics aspect of the case. Their work charted new ground and established the discipline for microbial forensics. In 2009, he and his team received the FBI Director's Award for Outstanding Scientific Achievement. Prior to joining the FBI, Decker received a doctorate in human genetics from the University of Michigan. He followed that with a postdoctoral fellowship in biological chemistry at Harvard Medical School, and then joined a startup biotech company, Gentech, where he developed diagnostic tests for infectious disease. In The Mirage Man, Pulitzer Prize winner David Willman recounts Decker's contributions to the anthrax investigation, and New York Times bestselling author Richard Preston acknowledges him for assistance with the book, The Demon in the Freezer, A True Story, in 2002. In 2008, The Washington Post featured Decker in a front-page article by two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning and national security reporter Joby Warwick. Trails of Odd Cells Led FBI to Army Scientist. The Stevenson's University Forensics Journal profiled Decker in its spring 2014 issue, and he has presented seminars on the anthrax attacks at FBI headquarters and major universities. So we have a star among us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right. So what did I leave out, Scott?
No, that pretty much covered it. That was written very well. Thank you.
Wonder why I got that.
A little bit about the book. When I retired, I got the idea, or was given the idea, to write a book about the anthrax investigation. Understanding it has been the largest investigation in the FBI's history, both in terms of personal resources and financial resources. There were already several books written on the case, but the reason I went ahead and did mine is a lot of people that worked on the case put their careers on hold. They risked their reputation and their careers to work on the case from 2001 to 2008. And these people were not mentioned in any of the books that had been written. So I wanted to give them credit. They're unsung heroes, really. That was my motivation and the theme of the book, recounting the anthrax attacks.
And you live here in Vegas.
I live in Vegas 5 years now.
You have a family here.
I have my wife, and we have two great dogs. Okay. That's my family here.
There you go.
The rest
there
of my family's up in Montana and up in Boston.
All right, okay. Because you're originally from Boston. Mm-hmm. Or at least you lived there a long time.
I was on the bank robbery task force in Boston for about 7 to 8 years.
Okay. The book you've written is about the anthrax case.
Correct.
More in depth, like where do you start with it and where does it end up?
I chose to start on September 11, 2001. And as when I give a talk, I always start out with, we all know where we were on that day. Mm-hmm. I have not met anybody yet
who can't remember where they were and what they were doing.
Unless they were 6 years old.
Yeah. Right.
And there are those people. It's been that long now. It's been 17 years. And I start with that because I believe that that event was the impetus for the mailing of the anthrax letters.
Okay.
In fact, when we got up to Ground Zero on September 12th, and I was there about 2.5 weeks. I ran a command post right adjacent to what we called the pile, the big pile of concrete dust and melting steel, which burned for quite a while. What people didn't know at that time, and I didn't find out until after a few days, is that the CDC and Department of Energy were busy monitoring the air for biological weapons. And the reason the CDC and DOE did it, they had the technology. Department of Energy was very big in developing things other than atomic countermeasures. They were also involved in biological countermeasures. So anyway, that was going on. They were watching. The CDC was watching the local area hospitals for any mysterious deaths, as we call them, and then they would be tracked back maybe to a biological weapon. The same occurred in Washington, D.C. The air was being monitored, and there were technicians constantly pulling little filters from the monitoring machines on top of the buildings in D.C. and taking them up to the Army lab at Fort Detrick for testing. And this was all going on in front of the person that we ultimately found did do the mailings. So long story short, that's why I started at September 11,
okay.
Because I believe that gave him the idea and the opportunity to mail the letters.
How long did it take this case to be resolved?
We started October 4, 2001, and we closed the case. I say we, the royal we, the Department of Justice closed the case in February of 2010.
Wow.
My goodness.
8 to 9 years.
Yeah. So you were on that case the entire time?
I was on it from 2001 until late 2006.
Okay.
And the reason I left, by 2006, we knew who had done it. We had identified the person. Part of my job during the investigation was to come up with new forensic techniques that might give us a lead as to who did the mailing. By 2006, mid-year, we knew who did it. And I felt we had really run the gamut of we had really run out every forensic thing that I could come think of. There was nothing to do forensically at the state of the art of technology in 2006. And the forensics had done its job. It had led us to the door of the person who did the mailing. It was then up to good old-fashioned police work to put the evidence together against him.
Right.
And that was emails, you know, very pulling records and so forth. Good old police work.
Did he know the entire time that you were on his heels?
No, I don't believe he really found out until 2006.
By then, though, he did know.
Well, he was interviewed at that point.
Mm-hmm. So he
was confronted.
Would definitely make him start thinking, ooh, they're on to me.
Well, he was confronted with it.
Yeah.
It was time to take the case to him and put it on his lap.
Wow. Where can we learn about this book? Where people go to buy it?
Of course, it's on Amazon.com. It's also available on the publisher's website, Roman.com, Roman and Littlefield. And if you can contact me or go to my internet site, there's a 30% discount code.
What is your internet site?
It's www.rscottdecker.com.
rscottdecker.com.
Yep.
What's the name of the book?
Recounting the Anthrax Attacks, Terror, the Amerithrax Task Force, and the Evolution of Forensics in the FBI.
And now you know why I had him say it.
There you go.
It was
there
the publisher's go. Choice, not mine. It's a little long.
All right. And Joyce, I'll let you introduce our next guest.
Certainly. Our next guest is Alan Livingston. Mr. Livingston is a native of Fort Worth, Texas, where he last resided before moving here to attend the University of Texas at Austin in 1974. He now lives with his wife in Las Vegas, Nevada, although there were many stops in between: Georgia, Texas, California, Ohio, Arizona, and Mississippi. Author Alan Livingston is a novelist, poet, memoirist, essayist, and short story writer. The author's first published title, the breakthrough novel Gabriel's Creek, was released in 2014. In a metaphysical fantasy exploring the gift of life, readers join a man's time of time travel and spiritual introspection. His guides are a cast of friends, a few living dead, and an unusual dog, through a final round on an even more unusual golf course. A personal family history describing the Livingstons' unique connection to the 1963 presidential assassination, the memoir Intersection with History, How My Family Crossed Paths with JFK and Oswald, was released in 2017. Like Gabriel's Creek, the book has a dedicated page on this site. Mr. Livingston is a member of Nevada's prestigious Henderson Writers Group. He has three novels in progress. Mr. Livingston also enjoys being a poet and looks forward to publishing a collection of his works in the near future. Lauded for the quality delivery of his verse, he occasionally performs at readings in the Las Vegas area.
Which is where the three of us met, Scott, Alan, and myself.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
We did a reading together. We'll talk about that in a minute. All right, so tell us a little bit about your books.
And where we can find your books.
First of all, thanks very much for having me. I would start by pointing anyone to my website, which is www.alanlivingston.com. That's A-L-A-N-L-I-V-I-N-G-S-T-O-N. There you can learn more about the works that I have published, which she was just telling you about, what's coming up, something in the spring that I'm kind of excited about. And were you to want to know more ad nauseum about me and my life, we got to talk about why that's all you have to do. But nevertheless, you can find that there too.
Okay.
The two works that I have, the first, my novel, Gabriel's Creek, is, as it says, it's an exploration of learning the lessons of life too late, if you will.
Okay.
A man discovers this with the help of a dog who leads him to an uncharted golf course in an unusual place. So a lot of things happen through this day where we're with this man as he plays around the golf. Please, anyone who hates golf, don't be scared away. I do get that a lot.
Yeah,
there is a lot of golf. But golf is the vehicle through which the story is told. It's not. It's, you know, people say it's a golf book. You see the cover. Oh, it's a golf book. We can talk about cover production another day. Anyway, that's done very well. It's been very well received, and I'm very proud of it. And it's gotten great reviews. My second book is nonfiction. It's a memoir. She indicated I was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas. Which was the site of President Kennedy's last night he spent, last meal he had, last speech he gave.
Right.
Before he got on a plane and took off and flew over my school and went to Dallas and a few minutes later was dead. Okay, well, there's anyone who was alive in 1963, much as Scott described, we've all experienced.
I remember where I was. I remember what was going on.
Yes.
If you were alive in 1963, much as we all have our experience with 2001, mm-hmm. you know exactly where you were and what
exactly.
was going on.
Yes.
In our family, it was a little bit different. When I first saw my mother when they let school out, she said the boy that they say did it was a student of mine. Lee Oswald was a student of my mother's in the fourth grade at the same school I attended in Fort Worth. Lee Oswald lived a couple of blocks from where I grew up. A lot transpired in the coming months as it related to my mother. My mother was kind of a pack rat. She had all the lesson plans. She had all the grade sheets. She had all that kind of stuff. And she had some pictures.
Oh.
If you've seen a picture of Lee Oswald as a child. Mm. I got a buck, says. It probably came out of a box my mom had out in the shed. Including her fourth grade picture, you know, and everybody on the steps and the teacher and the principal, just like we've all taken our whole lives. There's Lee Oswald. Okay. What's unusual about that? Nothing. Well, how about the picture of Lee Oswald and the dog he gave my mother sitting on our back porch?
Wow.
And, you know, he would stop by on the way home. My mother had a thing for people with issues. He'd stop by and visit and make sure he had something to eat, so on and so forth. Buy the book to learn more. My brother was a few years older than I, was in the Texas Boys Choir, which is a prestigious bunch of young kids with nothing to do, I guess. They've done a lot of albums. They've been all over the world, da-da-da-da-da. Well, he was in that. And that morning, they sang for the president at his breakfast in the Hotel Texas in downtown Fort Worth. Mm. The president asked him to do another song. If you watch the tape of the breakfast that morning where he gave his last speech and Jackie comes late and da-da-da.
I've seen that tape.
You've seen that? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to look hard. My brother's over there in the corner. On the president's way out, he stopped by and shook hands with some of the boys and exchanged a few words with them, and my brother was one of those. It was a day that it kind of stuck with my family for a long time, maybe more so than many others, and this is a recounting of that. Now, both of the protagonists in my family really didn't want anything to do with perpetuating this story. And that's why it really wasn't published until after my brother passed away a little over a year ago, a year and a half or so ago. That's the second book. The third book, which will be out in the spring, is called Bogies. It's a historical fiction piece that begins at the end of World War I.
Okay.
A collection of aviators from several different countries come together in an unlikely friendship with a French family. I think the period between the world wars is, historically speaking, a mystery to many people. We don't really know a whole lot. We just kind of think the armistice came along and woohoo, everybody's happy and the Germans are mad and everyone goes their separate ways. Europe was in quite a bit of turmoil, and this kind of connects that, this story kind of connects that to the lives of some of the people that might have come together. So I'm looking forward to that coming out as well. Again, the website is alanlivingston.com. You can buy the books there.
Okay.
Or, of course, on Amazon. Gabriel's Creek comes in hardcover as well, which you can get that on Amazon. Both books come in Kindle and ebook versions on a variety of platforms. Both books come in softcover.
All right. Well, gentlemen, today we're going to be talking, and Joyce, we're going to be talking about what makes a writer. According to creativecafe.com, different sources will give you varying answers. The article goes on to say, a writer is simply one who writes. No more, no less. There was a time when most considered real writers to only be authors. For the most part, those who identified as writers either worked at a newspaper or were unemployed, starving artist. And that's interesting, just talking about that in itself, because a lot of times someone who's creating something or considers themselves a creator, they don't really consider themselves a writer. And I learned that the hard way. I wrote a movie script back in the 90s, and I took a course on writing at Emory University. It was a series of seminars. And I remember the very first one, there were 80 people attending, and they asked everyone to stand up and talk about what they did or what they do. I brought my work with me, which most people did not. I had it in my hands, and I remember Mrs. Holloway asked me, so what do you do? And I said, well, you're a writer. And I said, no, I'm a creator. And she says, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't consider myself a writer. And she said, and why is that? And I said, well, I don't have a journalistic background. You know, I really didn't study to become a writer. And she said, what do you have in your hands? And I said, well, I have a script. And she goes, who wrote it? I said, I wrote it. She goes, you're a writer.
There you go.
And from that point on, I realized, you know, if you wrote something, you're a writer. You know, it isn't always about having the educational background that's necessary or what some people would consider as necessary. Or, you know, you don't have to be a journalist to become a writer or an author. It's the creativity portion of it that you put on paper that makes you a writer.
I think what I hear a lot is what I've experienced and what I hear from you, which is, I think, initially, a lot of us struggle with calling ourselves a writer because you don't really know what that means. I think we have a kind of a vision that means. I know in my case, I was, once I grasped the fact of calling myself a writer, I really was hesitant to call myself an author. Okay, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Well, to me and in my mind, author meant I can go into a bookstore and buy something you've ever written. I can find something in a library. I mean,
we
in my mind,
think of the big
at the
authors,
time.
Like, yeah, an Anne Rice or a Clancy or a Grisham, mm-hmm, or, you know, we always think of someone who's already published and established,
right,
as a well-known author.
Now, once I became published, I hopped right on that, and I was proud to get the business card printed that said, mm-hmm, I'm an author, because,
right,
I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Scott? When did you have you ever considered yourself to be a writer? And if so, what was that like going through that process?
I've always written as part of my job. I started in graduate school. I published my first paper in a scientific journal.
Okay.
In fact, the first paper I wrote, which was based on original research in genetics, came back. The reviews, what they do is the journals send them out to three peer scientists. And I was in grad school, so in my case, these would be full professors, associate professors, not my peers. Anyway, the reviews came back poorly written.
Okay. So did you think you were a writer? Did you still consider yourself a writer?
Well, with my background, I immediately got mad.
Okay.
And I spent a whole summer in the library rewriting that paper.
Okay.
And I sent it back to the same journal, and this time the reviews came back very well written.
Okay. Oh.
So at that point, I thought, well, maybe I can learn this stuff.
Actually, they helped you then.
Well, they forced me to improve.
Yeah, because, absolutely, I think that's what we go through as a yeah, journey as a writer, is we're always improving, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's
absolutely
through critiques, yeah.
And then in science, I published 8 or 9 more papers before I jumped into the FBI. And as an FBI agent, I think we just all saw the Kavanaugh confirmation.
Yes.
The FBI agents, several of them, spent the last week writing a lot of paper.
Yeah.
Reports of interviews, really, of a person. So I did that quite. And when we go to a bank robbery, which I did for 7 years, you can interview maybe 5, 6, 7 people in one day. And that's all got to be written up in 5 days. That's the policy. So I've always been a writer. And then when I retired, I began going to creative nonfiction conferences. It's held in Pittsburgh. And it's creativenonfiction.com. I learned that nonfiction writing doesn't have to be dry and boring.
Okay.
You can have a life also, like
yeah,
a novel.
Yeah.
That's the creative part in creative nonfiction. So I just kept working at it. And as you say, I don't think you ever stop learning, really.
But did you always consider yourself a writer as you were doing this process?
No.
Was that something? When did you consider yourself a writer?
No. As Alan said, or I think I heard him say, I'd make a distinction between writer and author also.
Okay.
I mean, I was a writer for most of my scientific and law enforcement career. To become an author, that was a pretty lofty goal, I thought. Mm. But I went to a show here in Vegas about a month or two ago, and there was a guy who's putting together a new technical magazine in something that I'm interested in, metallurgy, it's a hobby. And he had a sign up looking for talented writers that want to write in this field. And I gave my business card, which has a copy of my book on it, mm-hmm, my internet site, and I gave it to him. He goes, oh, you're a real author.
And that's when you felt like an author?
Yes.
What about you, Joyce?
I consider myself a writer, but didn't know that I did consider myself a writer early in my career because I had started out as a school teacher. Early on, had a few years as a school teacher, which you have to write. Then as a nurse leader, I guess is the term you would call, you have to write reports, and you have to learn how to run divisions, and you have to manage your you have to manage sites, and so you must be specific and concise. Mm-hmm. You must write well. So it took me a while to realize that if I took that talent and kind of switched it over a bit into an area that I loved, mm-hmm. and wrote every day about what I love, which was a secret for me. I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I could write every day. I guess I had to give myself permission. I don't know. I don't know how other writers do it. But I learned that if I write every day, it becomes important. And if I miss that day, something's not right with the day. So after that, I realized a writer is an author. They're one and the same, and away we went.
I remember writing as a kid in junior high. We created our own little Transylvania Times type thing. We drew our own characters. We wrote the scripts for them and made a newspaper, and we'd go around and put it on the neighbors' doors. So that really is when I started writing. I didn't take myself seriously until my first novel came out, and I was told by someone with a PhD that you don't have the credentials to become a writer.
Oh, my.
And then I set out to prove them wrong. And it's interesting. I really didn't consider myself, like you gentlemen were saying, and Joyce, maybe you agree, an author until my first book was out. Mm-hmm. It was in a chain of stores in Atlanta, Georgia. I walked into the store and found it on the bookshelf.
Yay!
And then I felt like an author. It's a process we go through to get to that place. And a lot of people think, well, you know, you haven't sold 100,000 copies or 2 million copies of your book, so why would you consider yourself an author? But the truth of the matter is, most self-published authors, for certain, you're lucky if you sell 100 to 1,000 copies, period. It is a state of mind, in a way, but I always tell everyone, if you're writing, you're an author. You're a writer.
Yes.
And it's interesting what you said about technical, because we have done shows on technical writing as well. You're a writer. If you're writing anything, you are a writer. And I think it's important to give yourself, you know, a pat on the back there. You've accomplished something with what you're doing.
Well, I think one thing that Scott mentioned prompts something that I hear a lot and I think very much about. Because of our professional lives before we, quote, became writers, and there's so many people that I've run into, I don't know about you, but there's so many people who have, quote, started writing late in life. They've started their books, rather, their mm-hmm. novels, their works, the novels. Later in life. So when someone asks, and I hear it a lot, whether it be at writers' conferences or wherever, well, how long have you been writing? Well, I was in kindergarten when I first... I mean, you know, what kind of question is that? But now, in Scott's case, and a lot of your stuff is in science and law enforcement, for you and nursing, I don't know where, you know, what comes up in that. For me, in the field of hospitality, where I was for 30 years, mm-hmm. and much of that in a managerial oversight capacity for many years in multi-property, five-star, five-diamond environments, I had to write a lot of what we called trip reports, particularly in a case where I was traveling a lot to a variety of properties coast to coast in the United States. You would be relaying what your trip was, what you oversaw, what the problems, the pluses and the minuses were to whoever. And I know, like, you said something, Scott, that triggered my memory of being told, this is great, but you're too verbose. Mm-hmm. You're too verbose. Well, let's see. That sounds like I could be a novelist when I grow up.
That's right. You know? It's a compliment.
Oh, you're on your way.
Who knew? Who knew? But, you know, I think we all do so much. Maybe there's a connection and maybe there's not.
I think you're onto something here. Even in what I do, you know, I was in the food industry most of my life. People would always come to me and ask me to write letters for them for one thing or another, whether it was a grievance or, you know, to debate something. And I always wondered, why do they ask me to do this? And maybe there is a knack for it. Maybe there's something there that, you know, we have the ability to do that. I don't know where it comes from. In 1980, I worked at a hotel in Las Vegas that closed, and I was out of work. And a friend of mine and I decided we were going to try and write something, just to be writing, no reason. We just wrote it. And we gave it to someone to look at, it was actually a woman who worked for me. She was a cashier, and she said, can I send this to my brother to look at? And I don't know who her brother is. She mentioned his name. I still didn't know who he was. And I said, okay, sure. So she sent it off to L.A., and he took a look at it and said, ask them to write 16 episodes around this. Maybe we can turn this into a pilot and create a television show around it. I didn't have enough sense to know how important this was because I was just a young kid. You know, I never really took it seriously. It happened to be Jay Summers, who was the director, producer, and writer of Green Acres. And he liked this and was going to pitch it as a television series. But at that time, there was another series that was already out similar. And at that time, they didn't like similarities. So it got nixed. But I never thought about that being that I maybe had the ability to write. So I never did anything with it until the 90s. I never took my writing seriously until then. If you love to write and you have the knack, you should never let that hold you back. You are a writer, mm-hmm. and there's nothing wrong with pursuing it. And I know what you said, Alan, about a lot of people wait until their later years. It seems like that's what I've done, but in reality, I haven't. I've been writing all along.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of that, and it may have happened to you, it certainly happened to me, and it happened to a lot of people yes. that I know, yes. and I could do a shameless segue into Gabriel's Creek because there's a little connection to this, okay. but life gets in the way.
It does.
You know,
does.
I mean,
yes,
one day you're, and in my case, one day you're one of the editors of a statewide award-winning high school newspaper, and you go off to college and think you're going to get into some sort of print journalism. And poof, one thing leads to another. Life gets in the way. You change your major. You go off in business.
You have a family to raise.
Bang, you got a family. Bang. What do you mean there's three of them? What do you mean? How many car payments? You know.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, and next thing so you know, true. What the heck happened?
Right.
And you look and you're, you
we
look
see it
like
all
us.
The, all
except
the time.
For her. She looked great.
All the time on reality shows, we see someone who's, you know, in their 30s, 40s, or 50s who are presenting themselves to the public as a singer for the first time because they gave up the pursuit of their careers for their family. So it's no different than for us as writers. What is a writer? It's anyone who has a desire to create something on paper. You know, if you have the want or the need to do that, you're a writer. It doesn't matter if you can't form a sentence well or your grammar's horrible. That's what you got an editor for. And that's what I learned as well. You know, it doesn't matter if you have the background for it. You hire someone to help you pursue, you know, your dreams. You know, you need someone to help you along that journey. And I think that's the difference between what a writer is and an author is, really, is that you're a writer who's taken to the next level and you actually accomplished what you set out to do. You're an author.
Yes, I agree. I agree. You take steps, and then one day you arrive at a new point, and you get information about where you're at and where you want to be. You take some more steps, and you arrive at a new plateau, if you will, and you see what other people around you are doing, or you look at people where you want to be, and so you take some more steps and some more steps. And all of a sudden, unbeknownst to you, you're where you wanted to be maybe a year ago or 5 years ago, and you're there. So you realize you did that by learning and taking steps. So you take some more.
Well, you certainly go from that point where I have a story to tell. I have something I want to create. I'm going to throw it down on paper. Oh, heck, I'll just get an editor to clean it up, which is smart. But there comes a point, at least it did with me, where you realize, wait a minute, this is a craft. Mm-hmm. This is a craft that has nuances that I need to learn and develop mm-hmm. To really do this successfully. And hopefully that's why novel number one graduates to novel number two. And next thing you know, they do hopefully get better and better and better.
Oh,
I know
yeah.
I know when I read my own work, whether it be the short stories or the poems or the whatever, I feel my improvement in, quote, the craft.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And I agree with you there. We really educate ourselves as we continue to write. You know, we're learning as we go with a lot of what we're doing. I don't care what your degree is. I have a friend who has two masters and a PhD and is so frustrated that he can't write a novel. And I think that sometimes we overthink it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, actually, writing is simplistic. You know, you really want to get down to, especially if you're doing fiction writing. You want the imagination to take over. You want it to lead you. You don't need to be thinking about what's proper syntax. You know, what's this word mean and what does that mean? You know, what can I replace it with? When you're writing, you don't think of any of those things. Mm-hmm. You're just being creative. You know, you're putting the process on paper and letting someone else helping you later on determine how to present it.
Mm-hmm. If you're not careful, you fall into, I guarantee you, we're all guilty. It's a term that, for me, comes from golf, but it's paralysis from analysis.
Exactly.
You know, yes. you beat it to death, and you beat it to death, and you beat right. it again. And when the smart person eventually says, that's enough, and sends it on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting, too. I actually, because I was considered myself a creator, I've probably got well over 100 stories that I've never finished that are sitting in the closet somewhere. I also create from dreams, so I'll have 2 or 3 dreams a week I'll get up and I'll write the outline down for. Yeah. And I think that was part of the problem in the past is I had convinced myself I didn't have the degree necessary to continue as a writer, and therefore I would never be a published author. And I really talked myself out of something that I probably had a really good knack for. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people do that. They'll talk themselves out of something when they really have the ability to do it. It doesn't matter whether you're writing true stories or fictional or romance or, in your case, yours is more of a memoir for the yes. first one. Yes. It's still, there's a creative process to it. It isn't just taking the real story or the true story and putting it on paper. You have to think about a process that you're putting it through that people are going to be interested in turning the next page. You know, so there is creativity to even a true story or a memoir. You have to present it in a way that people want to read it and continue reading it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I consider myself a novelist. Okay, you're not a novelist. Okay, I consider myself a poet. Okay, well, you're not a poet. Okay, you know, what do you consider yourself? Again, yeah. it's we're writers. I know we talked about it, Dime Grinds. That's the event you mentioned before.
Right, the three of us.
Where... You know, there are guidelines within the craft mm-hmm. that say you have to pick a genre and stay in that genre.
Oh, yes.
Right. That, yeah.
You mm-hmm. have to write all fiction or all nonfiction. Well, I've already violated that in 2 stinking books.
Myself included.
You know, so when you... I loved when I first went to aspectsofwriting.com and I saw your quote about... Fresh in me, it's dream something and write it.
Oh, if you can dream it, you can write it. A dream.
Dreams made Gabriel's Creek.
Yeah.
Dreams make a lot of my poetry. I do the same thing you do, and probably a lot of authors do, or writers do here. I just did that. Is we wake up and we go, holy crap, I got to write this down right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, later on you outline it, and maybe it becomes something that works, maybe it doesn't. Like we all have our works in progress, and then we all have our concepts, and a lot of those come from dreams. Well, nobody told my dreams that they have to stay in one particular genre.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. so maybe the right way to think about it is exactly as you say, and I'm gonna try to flip that switch in myself in coming days and weeks and months. Think of yourself more as a creator, and whatever comes out, comes out. What's, might not be that marketable, but, you know, well, what are we here for? I'm not here.
Yeah,
you know.
And I don't think a lot of people, I mean, there are some people who go into it. We talked about this a little bit, Joyce, on the last show. Mm-hmm, there are a few people who go into it with the ideas, I want to do this to make money. You know, there is a reason for doing it, and there's a specific genre they're looking at
yes.
to do. But for most of us, I think it's just about creating, you know, and like you said, the creator, if you put it on paper, you are the writer. You created that. You wrote it, you know, and I think that's what a lot of people fear is saying, now I'm an author, you know, I accomplished this. And that's a hard thing to get past. And we all three were at this, what did you call it? It was Dime Grinds, but I don't know what you would call it, a presentation, I guess, of our books.
Oh, that's the name
yeah.
of it. That's
and at the presentation, we had to do a reading, and I think that's another thing. When we consider ourselves a writer, that doesn't mean that you're a good speaker. I mean, I was scared to death. You know, that's another thing is when you become a writer, you have to start overcoming things that you might not have even thought about. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's being a writer is much more than just putting it on paper. Being a writer is being able to present yourself. You have to present what you wrote. You have to be able to go out there and say, this is me, this is what I am, this is what I'm about. And you have to do it in sometimes in the form of reading from your book, which is what terrifies me. But as a writer, you have to overcome those fears. That's another part of being a writer, is putting yourself out there for the public to see.
Do you think it's a generational thing or what? That I know, again, in my case, and when I, quote, started writing, unquote, that's another kettle of fish. But, you know, we had that vision of, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write and I'm going to produce, and yikes, here's going to be, I'm going to have these novels and all these books about my life experiences and so forth. Wait a minute. Nobody said anything about self-promotion. Nobody said anything about going out and creating websites and managing that. Nobody said identifying editors and picking one. And nobody said about book signings. And I mean, and some of us, we all have different things we love and we hate. I could care less about public speaking. It scared you to death,
but you did
great.
I hear what you're both saying, and I think it goes much deeper than that. I think that in each of us, there is a deep-seated need to be accepted and to be accepted on a public level. Mm-hmm. And so if we are willing to publicly go in front of our peers and say, I'm going to share with you in a public way something that is dear to my heart, and here it is. And I'm willing to say to you, this is what I've written because it means something to me, and so here I go. And you risk it all by saying, this is what I've written, and I'm going to say it, and here it's been said, because they might not like it. And for your peers to say to you, I don't like what you've written, and you are putting yourself out there as an author among them, you risk everything.
Being a writer is being a promoter, because that's what you're talking about.
Yes, yes.
It's being a marketer.
That's right.
It's much more than just putting the written word on paper.
No doubt.
And Scott, what's your experience with that?
Yeah, sitting here listening to everybody. For me, it's been very difficult. And I spent 22 years as an FBI agent.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you reach a certain executive level with the proper training, we are not allowed to talk to the press.
Uh-huh.
You get days off if you do it. Some people will do it anonymously, but if people find out, you're going to do some time on the bricks. As an FBI agent, I never had an Facebook account. I never used Twitter. I never did any of that stuff. Sometimes we do go undercover. Sometimes we don't want to be recognized.
Right.
Sometimes it can be very dangerous to be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
If you happen to be chasing bank robbers and so forth. What I found in every big bank robbery case I worked, there was always a murder somewhere in there. In that case, they had killed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It just went with the territory. So that was the environment. Now, my publisher told me, put an internet site together, start getting on social media, et cetera, et cetera. It's 180 degrees for me.
And, you know, we wouldn't think of that. What you just shared, I would never have thought of that until you just mentioned it. And so it is a new experience for you.
And another, my wife just retired as an FBI agent last year. And I do a lot of Facebook with the family and stuff now. She doesn't have a Facebook account.
Wow.
Again, there's the training. And
It makes complete sense. Yeah, it does make sense.
So, and as you say, as I was listening, now I'm out there and I'm open. Mm-hmm. Word gets back to me. Other retired agents around the country know I wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they pick it up, the first thing they do is look at the index to see if they're in it.
Now, were you not allowed to have Facebook, or you just chose not to do Facebook?
We chose not to.
Oh, you chose not to.
Yeah.
Okay. Part of the culture.
Huh? Well, the photos. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sneaking around the bad parts of Boston following bank robbers, and then they go, hey, isn't that Decker?
We saw him. Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. It makes perfect sense.
That's right.
But that's part of what we're talking about. When, you know, what is an author or what is a writer? A writer, you know, is everything you're talking about. It's someone who has to go out there and promote themselves on social media.
Absolutely.
You know, it's someone who has to go out there and do the speeches that we had to do, 2 weeks ago. You do have to put on a different hat, and you have to become a different person. Mm-hmm. It's comfortable for me to sit here and talk to the three of you. But when I have to go out there and talk in front of my peers, as Joyce was saying, that scares me to death.
Of course.
Because in our mind, we're thinking they're going to be judging me. They're going to be looking at, you know, and I'm always thinking, well, Alan's a better writer, or Scott's a better writer, or Joyce is a better writer. And those things are all going through your mind. So it doesn't matter what you do or what your profession is. You may be able to handle that quite well. Mm-hmm. But now you have to go out there and present yourself as an author. Mm-hmm. And that's a different ballgame altogether. I can speak in front of 1,200 people and not miss a beat. But you put me in front of 12 people that I know are authors, and that's a different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Well, 1,200 people where you're talking about a subject that, you know, you're near and dear to, that's one thing. But you were reading your own work.
Yes.
And whether you're reading your own work, and I don't know about you guys, I have the same anxieties at times in the writer's group where we're reading for critique. You know, there might only be 8 people in the room, but it might as well be 8,000.
Exactly.
You know, just when you're facing that. But again, I wonder if a lot of it is just like what Scott experienced in what makes such complete sense in law enforcement with the FBI. He's talking, and I'm thinking about my dad, who built airplanes for 43 years and was on the initial design team of the F-16 and stuff like that. Top secret clearances for 40-something years. You couldn't get nothing out of him, nor could anybody else, about anything he did at work. Well, what's the point? Just like Scott, your condition, part of your culture is to not push what you do and things about it. Okay, now take salespeople, for example. And I don't know, again, we all know so many different writers now. They're the ones that seem to be comfortable with selling themselves, pushing their product.
Right.
You know, in my case, most of that time in the hospitality industry and a variety of different things was in accounting. Okay, well, that's kind of black and white, cut and dried. It's right or it's wrong. But there's very little self-promotion involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there are so many features, just like you point out, of what the job of writer entails. It's a long list that, as we talked about 20 minutes ago, that doesn't come up when you first start talking about or thinking about being a writer. You don't think about all of these things that now you're going to have to do because you have this thing in your head that somebody else is good. Someone else will handle all that. Well, now we have this long list. Each of us has probably 2 or 3 things that we're good and comfortable with as a product of our culture and our background, and the rest of it is just foreign to us.
So yes. The writer is many things. Yes. The writer isn't just putting something on paper.
Absolutely.
It's not just creating an image of what we want people to see in their minds as they read. You're really far more than that, especially when you become a published writer. You're now an author, or you're a newspaper columnist, or, you know, even with what you're talking about when you write to journals, you are a published author. If you're writing to a medical journal, you're a published author.
You are. Yes.
So you may not think of it in those terms, but you really are. Mm-hmm.
Targeted audience.
Absolutely. You have a targeted audience.
Well, before my book was published, I went to a few writers' conferences, and I think I filled out some questionnaires, and it did ask, are you published?
Ah.
And I had to think about that, because as you say, I've been publishing scientific papers since the late 80s.
Uh-huh.
And, well, I guess I am, but I don't think that's what they mean.
So you really hadn't convinced yourself that you were a writer yet?
Correct.
Yeah, and that's
even
really
though he
interesting.
Really was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, absolutely.
But a published writer, but I didn't feel like it because, I don't know, it didn't seem to be the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is really interesting, mm-hmm. too, that you would even think that way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a lot of people, that's all they do is they're an article writer. Right. They'll write for newspapers or magazines.
Freelance.
And make quite a good living.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a friend in Hawaii who that's all he does for a living.
Mm-hmm. I think most of the, as the way I understand, most of the good nonfiction writers, at least, do make their living writing for the New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly, Richard Preston, John McPhee, very prolific writer, but I think he made his living with the New Yorker.
Yeah.
McPhee's been writing articles for the New Yorker for years.
So many people are so afraid of taking the next step of becoming an accomplished writer. It's one thing to be a writer. It's another thing to become an accomplished writer. And I remember the story about Stephen King, how I think it was Carrie he was writing, and he had decided this is not a novel that's going to go anywhere. And he took it and threw it in a trash can. And when his wife was cleaning house and found the novel in the trash can, she pulled it out and brushed it off and said, "Why did you throw this away?" It's interesting how we become writers in that there are different things that push us beyond the point of just becoming a writer, that to really be an accomplished writer. And in his case, it was his wife who didn't let him give up on that dream. In my case, it was someone telling me, "You can't be." You know, there are a lot of reasons why we do it. And Joyce, what prompted you to become an accomplished writer?
Well, thank you for the compliment, first of all.
You are all sitting here, our accomplished writers. Let's just be honest
and,
here.
And I will take the compliment. Thank you very much. My first book was a story of our family and how I grew up and how that affected me later in life. I decided that it was affecting me in ways I didn't like, and it was time for me to not only discuss it with my other family members, but sit down and write about it, because I'd had enough experience in life to know that other people were affected by those same issues. And so it was time for me to see if I couldn't lay the information out and help other people, because I also have a quite extensive background in mental health and physical health, and I knew that if you don't face those issues, they will always come back. So you might as well face them, talk about them, resolve them if you can, and move along. That's what prompted me to do the first book. There's a whole story behind just deciding to write the book. That's a whole nother show in itself. But that's what motivated me. I had this desire within me to make it better for someone else and to write down what was in my head anyway.
Yeah. But the writing ability had always been there, because you said you used it all the
obviously
time.
Obviously so, because I'd used it for years and years and years, but in other ways.
We're out of time. So, Scott, where can we learn more about your book?
My internet site is probably the best place. www.rscott, S-C-O-T-T, Decker, D-E-C-K-E-R. allonewordcom, and if you go to there are links to Amazon and the publisher's site, and the discount code is there also.
All right, and Alan?
My website is www.alanlivingston.com. That's A-L-A-N-L-I-V-I-N-G-S-T-O-N. And there's a sign-up for a newsletter mailing list that you can find out more about coming products as well as those that are already out.
And Joyce?
I have a website, linesoflistening.com. I also have a blog, which is linesoflistening.blog.wordpress.com, which is dedicated to health and wellness, and everything's available on Amazon.
Well, I'd like to thank everyone for being on the show, and I'd also like to encourage our listeners to write to us. Let us know what you would like to discuss on the show, how we can help you. If you're an author, whether you're a newbie or an experienced, it does not matter. We like to have both, and often we'll have both on the show at the same time.
Yes.
Because we learn from each other. I always say it doesn't matter whether you're from Chicago, Sydney, or Budapest. We'll interview you. You know, just let us know you're interested. We've got ways. It's called the internet.
Yes, yes.
And a phone. So just go to the contacts page on aspectsofwriting.com and fill out the contact information, and we'll get it, and I'll answer within 48 hours. I would like to thank our guests, Scott Decker and Alan Livingston, along with my co-host, Joyce K. Gatchenberger, filling in for Janet today. To find links to our guest website, please visit aspectsofwriting.com. There we will find the video also to our past shows on youtube.com and our archive shows. You will also find links to the syndicated show on iHeartRadio, iTunes, AMFM247.com, Roku TV, and several more. We're on several terrestrial stations, so just check that out as well. Aspects of Writing is also on Blog Talk Radio now, so just go to Blog Talk Radio and type in Aspects of Writing. We archive all of our shows on Aspects of Writing, so just go to aspectsofwriting.com, and there you can find the archive shows. Until next week, this is your host, James Kelly, reminding you, if you can dream it, you can write it. Thank you, everyone, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening to Aspects of Writing. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss every aspect of the writing industry. Until then, if you can dream it, you can write it.